I'm Maria. I'm an adult child of two alcoholic parents. I'm a recovering codependent and alcoholic. And in recovery, I've learned that there is no one to blame. I'm not a victim, and I'm powerless over everything happened to me because of the generational nature of family dysfunction. Just have to put that out there. Always, every time I speak, I say that because I know that from doing the work. I am really honored and privileged to be here tonight. I have to tell you that I've listened to every single speaker meeting from Santa Barbara. And in the beginning of my recovery, it helped me so much to just hear all those people talk about the stuff that they did, because I could relate to everything that they were telling me, and it just really resonated with me, and it made me realize that I wasn't alone. So this is really a powerful experience for me to be able to come here and share my experience, strength, and hope with you, because I know how much it helped me in the beginning of my work, and it still continues to help me. This fellowship helps me so much. So it's kind of funny. 3 weeks ago, one of my fellow travelers came up to me after our home meeting, and she goes, "Oh, did Janie ask you to speak at the Santa Barbara meeting?" And I just went, like, "Oh my God." I was like, I immediately said, "Oh no, I think I'm working that night," you know, and of course kind of got scared and was like, "Oh, I don't know." But I started thinking about it when I got home, and I'm like, okay, I'm just, you know, I'll wait for her to call me or whatever, and you know, whatever. I just kind of let it go. And in the morning, I really started thinking about it in my morning devotional about what it was that was keeping me from doing that. And I started journaling in it and just thinking about it. And what happened was I started writing an outline for what I was going to talk about tonight. And I meditated. And of course, after I finished meditating, I said, "You're going to speak," to myself out loud. And here I am. And that's how this program works. It's all based on courage, willingness, and effort. And that's truly where it lies, for me at least, speaking from my own experience. So what I was thinking about in my journaling is for fear and love. I was thinking, I put at the top of the page, I put fear versus love. And I was thinking about my life and how I spent my life pretty much living in fear, you know, up until I came to ACA. And being here has been really a return to love and connection and intimacy for me on a level that I never thought that I would experience. So it's really powerful. And I'm just so grateful that I get to be a part of this. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So tonight I'm going to share my story with you from the perspective of the places of fear I went to in my experience and how I'm changing those places in my recovery. So I guess where I want to start is probably with my family, my mom and my dad, and their experience briefly, and, you know, how the things manifested in my life. So my mom and dad are both alcoholics. My dad's a recovering alcoholic. He got sober when I was 13. And my mom is still actively drinking. Dad was a full-blown alcoholic, pretty much drunk up until he got sober, to the point of, you know, being to the place of either stop drinking or you're going to die. Mom's pattern was more of binge drinking when I was younger. And then when she started becoming a carpenter, she started drinking regularly because of the physical nature of her job and just the environment. Lots of drinking going on there. So that was their drinking pattern. But where the story starts is in their families. My dad's family was very religious, militaristic, I couldn't spit that out, very patriarchal and very religious, big family of 9 children. His mother was very, very, saw the world through rose-colored lenses and very non-emotional, just kind of there, not really paying attention. Dad was called boss, so you know that he was the boss of the family. And yeah, so he started drinking really young, started when he was about 13, and so did 2 of his brothers. So there was 3 people with addiction in his family. Mom, the same thing, started drinking really young. Mom's family was a little different. Her dad was a womanizer and a drinker. Her mom was physically and verbally abusive to her. So they both started drinking really young and obviously did not grow up emotionally, and just did not get the emotional care that they needed as children. So what happened? 2 ACA people meet and they start trying to fix that family of origin. And there comes my brother and sister and I. My mom got married when she was 16. My dad was 27. They moved off to Oregon and started their family. And I think my dad's drinking and womanizing. She married her father, obviously. He progressed, and by the time my mom was 22, she had three children, and she decided that she was going to leave my dad, because I pretty much think he was off doing his own thing. I do have five half-brothers and sisters, and they're all kind of in the age range of my brother and sister and I, so he definitely was having a life outside of the life. So that ended, and then my story truly begins there, I think. She left my dad when I was two, and we moved away, and I saw Dad off and on. When I spent time with him, it was always a party, and he had his friends around, and there would be lots of drinking and that kind of thing. And by the time I was about maybe four, around there, the visit stopped, and I just kind of lost that relationship with him. And the only time I would see him was maybe if I was at my grandma's, and he'd come over drunk asking for money or doing that whole thing. It wasn't about connecting with me. It was about getting the money for the alcohol. So there's mom, single mom. That's where this stuff really lies for me, is with my mom. I have a huge mother wound, a big giant one, and this program has really helped me heal a lot of that. So who was my mom? Very hardworking, very resourceful woman. I mean, the smartest, resourceful person I think I've ever met. I'm very talented. She was 22 with three kids, and she had to support herself. My dad did not help her at all, and she always provided us with a nice home, food on the table, clothes. She would sew our clothes. I mean, she was really resourceful. But the one thing that she could not do was pay attention to me and love me, and it really affected me as a child. Not having that emotional connection, that hugging, the being told that you're loved, just kind of being there. I always kind of felt like there was a sense of judgment, and that I was a burden to her because she was so stressed out just trying to survive. I mean, we lived in survival mode, and I think my brother and sister and I coped with it by being good. I mean, honestly, I think that's how we coped with our family life, was we just all stayed low on the radar. We did what mom said. She had this really up and down emotional personality, and she would get upset about things, and she would rage and, you know, cuss and go off. And it was just like, if I could just stay low on the radar and not upset her and do whatever I could to make her happy, you know, and get that praise by doing, you know, the dishes or the laundry or mowing the lawn. It was like, that's what I would do, because I just wanted her love and affection, and I just couldn't get it from her. She didn't know how to do it. Nobody taught her how to do that. The same thing with my dad. I call him dad, but he's not really a dad to me. He never told me he loved me. He never hugged me. No emotional connection at all from either one of my parents. And then of course there's the drinking on top of all that. So I'm seeing all this chaos and uncertainty and not sure what to expect. Mom's drinking pattern was more of a binge thing, and like, you know, she'd pass out or she'd go to a friend's house and leave us with somebody else. And it was kind of like, I just never knew what was going to happen. So I think that really affected me a lot. So I learned to fear my world from the inside out, really. And I think I kind of developed, like, I call it not, we say false self, but I call it my shadow self. And I think my shadow self developed when I was about, I recognize 5 or 6 as being the age where I started really having all these people-pleasing tendencies and trying to cope with my world by being that lost child and kind of hiding from everyone. In my family, we didn't talk. There was no trust. We didn't express our feelings. There was no hugging. There was no joy. There was no laughter. Mom was very, very serious and always about business and getting it done. She was a total doer. So there was no time for fun or laughter or any of that kind of stuff. And her role was kind of like, she played this role of being like the hero and the martyr that saved us from the drunken dad. And so I kind of looked at her like a god. Like, I looked up to her. Like, I just wanted her love and approval so much. And I just kind of like bowed down to her. Like, she was just this saint that did this wonderful thing, getting me away from my drunken father. And I think that's how my brother and sister kind of dealt with her too. Things would happen. Mom would be passed out in the bathroom, you know, and the door's locked, and us three are out there trying to unlock the door, but there was no conversation about that ever. No explanation for anything. No explanation about the raging, nothing. So it was like, I didn't learn how to express what I needed or how I felt. I didn't learn boundaries. I just really just did not have a model of any of that. And the hard thing about it was, when she drank, she was really loving and like really happy and just one of those drinkers that would be like, oh, you're the best, you're amazing, you're this. So I got this mixed message, you know, that I was great, but then I wasn't. After that, I was just like, oh, I'm there, whatever, you know. So that was really, really, really affected the way I dealt with other people. So yeah, I just learned how to read people. I walked on eggshells. I learned how to read people. I was hypervigilant, people pleaser. Just really lived in this praise deficit, and it really took me to places of shame and abandonment. My self-worth, I didn't have any self-worth because nobody ever praised me. And I felt really alone because mom would be working, and you know, I was getting myself off to school at an early age, and my brother and sister and I were kind of taking care of each other. My sister took on the role of being almost my mom. It was kind of just, I think by about the time I was 9, I was really like getting myself dressed, ready to go to school, doing everything on my own. I just really felt alone. And that's something that I noticed in when I did step four was in the pattern was that feeling I had as a child, the two things that went together were that I felt alone, and it always had to do with the drinking and the behavior. That's just something I really recognized in doing that step four and getting out of that denial around it. Like, this, I'm not crazy for thinking this way. This is not, you know, because I wasn't physically abused, I wasn't sexually abused, but I was just emotionally neglected. So it made it really hard for me to identify that this is a trauma to me, you know. This is my trauma, and this affected how I do everything. And I'll get into the stuff that manifested in my young adult life in just a few minutes. But So by my teen years, I really felt like a roommate to my mom. I mean, our household was like brother, sister, and I. We all had jobs. We all got great grades. We took care of ourselves. Very responsible. I played sports. Nobody ever came to watch me in sports. Nobody gave me a ride. I took care of it all myself. I kind of was in a fog almost of this like low-grade depression. I think that's one of the ways that I dealt with the environment, was just kind of always being this, I call it a fog. I don't really know how to deal with this. Probably dissociation would probably be a better term for it. But one of the things that I did start doing in my younger teen years was using food for control. I would eat compulsively, and I also had a bout with anorexia. And part of that also was obsessive exercising, just trying to seek control and approval from my peers, but also from my family. So what happened with that, it was very interesting because I was anorexic. I mean, in the ninth grade, I was anorexic. I was really thin. I had dropped like 25 pounds. So mom finds me in the garage jumping rope at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and she finally realized that, okay, she has a problem. She takes me to the doctor. And you know, in the next couple of weeks, I start eating again, and everything kind of balanced out. And I started kind of getting back to a healthier state. But what I realized in that is that it was such a plea for attention from her, that once she gave me that attention, it was like, okay, I can do this. You know, I have to listen to her because she's the God, and you know, I have to do what she says. So there went away the anorexia, but all those core issues and those underlying things with food and with exercise to this day still affect me, and I still have to work on them. One thing about it though that I do recognize is that by doing the work, I'm learning to love myself, and I'm a lot gentler with myself. I'm not doing like 3-hour CrossFit workouts. I'm going hiking and running and doing things that my inner child enjoys. And there's a lot more gentleness with it. Still a lot of hypervigilance around food. I use food for comfort sometimes. Sometimes I don't eat to control. So, I mean, those are two things that I like to say out loud because I think it's a common problem that a lot of us have. So, you know, we may look okay on the outside, but internally, I mean, it definitely is a place of control for me. I mean, I recognize that, and I thought maybe if I could be perfect enough and look the right way, maybe I would get that love and attention from my peers, my boyfriends, my parents, you know, but it wasn't where it was at, and I learned to seek out some other things, too, that we'll get to right now. So, I graduated from high school. I had a boyfriend at the end of high school that I had a nice codependent relationship with. He was very much like a father figure to me. I was very childlike in all my relationships in my 20s. And it was very codependent because I'm this 18-year-old, and I'm going to school, and I'm working, and I'm doing the laundry, and I'm cooking the meals, and I'm taking care of this guy pretty much because that's what his mother did for him. So I was kind of in this place of being so young, and like he wanted to marry me and all this stuff, and I just completely walked away from it, and kind of went into this place of I could feel in my being at like 20 years old that I wanted to seek out this excitement. It was like this feeling of like I just wanted excitement. I had never used drugs or alcohol at this point. Maybe drank a couple times in high school, but never really got into it. So this is where I started fearing my world through shame, self-abandonment, and excitement. And this is where a lot of that stuff in my childhood manifests in my relationships with men and the things that I do to comfort myself. I sought out excitement. My inner drugstore was calling me. I never wanted to be like my mom and dad and drink. That was the last thing I wanted to be, was my mom and dad. And because I wasn't under my mom's reign anymore, it was like, okay, I am free. I had no boundaries. I had no idea what drugs and alcohol did. I just went for it. I was like, I'm going to try all of this stuff. So at 20, I started drinking and smoking a lot of pot. And what I found out was that the pot would really help my inner critic go away, and like my mind wouldn't be going so much, and definitely the drinking would help with the shame and the feelings that would come up. It would just be a way to numb them and get rid of them right away. And part of that too is that there would be this false sense of intimacy with people, because I always had a hard time connecting with people being sober, and I couldn't do the social thing. It was always really awkward for me. So this opened the door for like, okay, I'm good. I can socialize and be okay with myself. And part of that, you know, self-abandonment, shame, and excitement was seeking out relationships with men. I was very promiscuous in my 20s, and I really, really used sex as a way to, I think, seek out shame hits. That was one of the ways I used it, but I also looked and thought that it was love, and that was the way you got intimacy, was to be sexual. But what I learned in my, four-step inventory about relationships is there was a pattern in my relationships with men, because I had a lot of relationships with men seeking out this love that I didn't ever experience and I wanted so badly. It was always a pattern of I would pick guys that were definitely addicts in some way, shape, or form. They were very non-emotional. and they just... I would be so childlike with them. I would chase after them. I would run away. I would hide. I just could not figure out how to do a relationship, because it was either too much or too little for me. And the sexuality mixed in that just was a really confusing thing. So it was like I was drinking, I was partying, I was having sex, I was having many relationships, and just really, really struggling with why I was doing this. It was like I didn't understand why I would do all these things and seek out these big, huge shame hits. And I tried. I really tried. I think from about like 23 to about 26 to just kind of figure out why I was doing all this stuff. I just could not figure it out. I would move to different apartments. I would get different jobs. I would get sober for a while. I started seeing a therapist for a while, and I don't think she knew about ACI. I wish she did, because it would have really helped me to go to an ACA meeting at this point. Instead, I thought, maybe I'll try some antidepressants to help with my depression, and I tried them, and they kind of helped me function a little bit better, but they did not get rid of, they were not going to cure that, that wound of my little girl. That is not, they weren't going to do what I needed to have done. And these patterns would go on for years and years and years, of course. So by the time I got to be about 26, I finally graduated from college. I thought, okay, I'm ready to be an adult. I'm ready to start a serious relationship and get married and have kids. So I picked somebody that was a friend that I had known for 6 years. He had been a roommate of mine off and on, and we were party buddies pretty much, but we had never had a romantic relationship. So we ended up starting to date, and he was ACA as well, of course, and had a lot of the same abandonment and same experience as a child, so we definitely related to each other, and life was just like a big party with him, because he's an alcoholic too, so we had a crazy time for a while, and eventually we got married after a couple years, and we thought we were going to fix our family of origin, and we really did think that we were going to fix our family of origin and do it better. There wouldn't be any fighting, we would have this beautiful, calm family. I would be a stay-at-home mom, and everything would be great. But that's obviously not what happened. So I was married to this man for 14 years, and so at 30, I decided I wanted to have a child, and, I stopped drinking and, kind of sobered up and stopped the smoking and all the things that you do when you get pregnant. He kind of mellowed out a little bit too. He still kept drinking, but not so much. then my son was born. And I really, like, once I had a child, it was like I transferred my codependent behavior to my child. I didn't need this man anymore, because I had my son. I could get the love from my son. I got to this place of fearing my world through isolation, control, and anger. That's how I did it after I had my first child. I started fearing it through this isolation, control, and anger. And it was over a 14-year period that this monster grew inside of me. So what happened was, I abandoned my husband for my son, Dash. And the reaction was, you know, his abandonment flared up, of course, and he got to be really angry, just really angry, and just he started drinking a lot and verbally abusing me, and just it was just a real not good situation, and it went on for a long, long time. I think after about a year, after I stopped nursing my son, I started drinking again and was getting into some of those same patterns. And it's kind of funny because the pattern was more of a binge drinking pattern like my mother. Thank God that I recognized it. The last time I drank was in November 7th, 2008. I got so drunk that I passed out with my kid in the house, and it really, really freaked me out. So the next day I just said, no more drinking. I'm not going to be my mom. And I stopped drinking, but you know what? I was not emotionally sober at all. Not at all. There was a lot of anger and a lot of control going on, in huge ways. So, you know, the way to fix that would be in, you know, a few more years when my son is about 5, have another baby. So I had my daughter Afton. And I had been working off and on through this whole time, and once I had Afton, it was like I just decided that I was going to stay home, which is, you know, an awesome thing to do for kids. But the reason why I was going to stay home was not because I was wanting to be there for my kids. It was a choice made out of fear, truly. It was like I could isolate from the world. I didn't have to be a part of the world. I could just have this little world that was centered upon my children. And it did not serve me in any way. It did not serve me. I just really got angry and controlling, and just was really turning into my mom in a lot of ways. I mean, there was no joy. There was no laughter. There was no smiling. I just kind of shut down. I mean, I was there. I loved my kids, and I hugged them and told them I loved them because I, you know, of course, was not going to do the same thing my mother did, but it was on a superficial level. It wasn't coming from a true place of joy. And the other part of that staying home was that I was so afraid because I was so financially dependent on my ex-husband. You know, I didn't have a means to make a living. I had good jobs in the past, and, you know, I started taking care of my kids and had been not working for so long. It was like, oh, God, now I got to try to go get a job, and I'm in this place of huge fear. But what happened was, I think this is when the unmanageability came in, and I realized what was going on, and just kind of, it was like eye-opening. I got really mad one day, and I went in the bathroom and I pulled the clock off the wall and I slammed this glass clock into the sink. And that just was like the ultimate anger you could show to me. And I was just like, wow, I cannot believe I just did that with my children in the house. And I remember just walking out of the bathroom and just standing at the kitchen sink going, you got to go back to work. You got to take a baby step, do something to get out of this, because this is not working. And I did. I did. I went to work at my son's school and got a little part-time job, and just started, you know, progressing and doing well and got better positions. And after about 6 months, I kind of got a little more self-esteem and was feeling a little more stable. And I was able to tell my ex-husband I'm leaving. And I did. And it was the best decision I've ever made because it brought me here. So I went to a therapist at this point and to help with my kids get through the divorce. It wasn't for me, it was for my kids, of course. I went to the therapist and she said, well, have you ever gone to ACA? And I'm like, no, but at this point I'm willing to try anything because, you know, my life is just in shambles and I have no idea how I'm going to support myself and get through this and find a place to live. And it was just really scary for me, really scary. So I attended my first ACA meeting two years ago in April. My birthday is actually April 26th. And I walked into the room, and the first thing that happened was this beautiful lady came up to me and gave me a big hug. I don't see her. Linda, where are you? And I remember it was like the first experience I had of a woman just embracing me and loving me. And I was so broken. I just was crying, and I was so upset. And it was like this huge feeling of just like, wow, what is this place? And then I started listening to everybody, and it was like, wow, this is where I need to be. So what I did was I just started coming to meetings, and eventually after, you know, a month or so, I started sharing and talking and started to learn how to talk, trust, and feel, I think. That was the biggest thing I took in the beginning. I didn't get a sponsor right away. I drove all over the place to meetings. I went to a lot of workshops. I listened to all the speaker meetings while I was working, of course, and absorbed I listened to so many different ACA recordings from all over the place, and just started really taking in what people were saying, and, you know, journaling about it and thinking about it, and really just kind of getting a good understanding of how the program works. And it took me like a good year until I got a sponsor and started working the Yellow Book. But once I did that, it was like I came out of this denial and these places of shame, and I started to trust women. I mean, it was like I was talking openly with somebody about all my shit, and it was like, wow, this is amazing. I'm letting some of this stuff go. And it was beautiful because it was like I would tell her something, and I'd think, oh my gosh, she's going to hate me, and she's going to judge me or whatever. And I was like, no, it's okay. It's okay. And it really just made me feel supported and loved in a way I never had by a woman. I think what happened in, you know, starting to work the steps is I started letting go and turning things over. And that fear that I had that was so internalized on everything that I did it released itself a little bit. And the things that were so scary to me became less scary because I turned my life over to God. And I just understood that, you know what? I can only control my side of the street. I can only do what I can, and everything else is out of my hands. And once I did that, it was like so many doors opened for me. So many doors. It just, my life took a turn in the right direction big time. It's just, been one of the, it's been the biggest gift of my life truly is to do this work and to understand these things, because now I'm happy, joyous, and free, and I don't have to live in that place of fear. It's been just huge. I think in recovery, I'm really learning to love my world from the inside out. I love me. I take care of me. I'm learning to let go of my fear and trust in higher power and myself and others. I'm changing from within and building a trusting relationship with my inner child. That's been the biggest thing this last year, is that relationship with my inner child. I listen to my inner critic. I look at how my inner drugstore plays out. I allow myself to feel and comfort my inner child, because they all work together big time. It's really a process of returning to love and intimacy and closeness with myself, but everybody else. And, you know, in the fellowship, of course, but also in my working life and in the world in general and the way I relate to people. So what does growing in love look like? To me, it looks like the biggest thing is my relationships. I really have much more honest relationships with people that are not based on people-pleasing. I'm learning how to take care of myself and ask for what I need. And I'm learning to let go of the codependent relationships that have affected me so deeply with my ex-husband and with my mother. I can see their codependence, and it is a beautiful thing to see that they are persecutors, and they want to persecute me and make me the victim and take care of me, and I don't let it happen anymore. And it has been so powerful. I'm learning to have compassion for them, but also set boundaries, which has been a huge thing. Mom doesn't have power over me anymore. I'm an adult with her, and it is just an amazing thing. I'm still grieving the loss of having a mother, big time, but I can love me, and I can love my little girl that's been wounded by that, and it's just really a process. I mean, it takes a lot of work, and there's still times where I curl up in a ball and cry, and you know what? It's okay, and that's part of the process. But I'm getting stronger in those two relationships, which really just, I mean, they are what made me hit bottom. I mean, truly, I believe that, especially with my ex-husband. And obviously, I still have to have a relationship with both of them because they're, you know, they're tied to my children. The relationship with myself, I think I'm more of a friend to myself. I practice good self-care. I'm rewriting the old script and these things in my mind that, you know, have always made me go to negative places. My thoughts are so much more positive, and so much more kind and loving to myself. There isn't that real harsh judge that persecutes me for everything that I do. I can let it go. The relationship with my kids has definitely changed a lot. They are getting the tools of ACA firsthand. They're learning to talk about their feelings and deal with their emotions in a positive way. I can see my behavior for what it is. I can use steps 9 and 10 and make amends and look at my behavior in everything that I do with them, because I am not nearly a perfect parent. I make mistakes, and I see my mom in my parenting a lot of the time. But I know I'm powerless over it, and I'm just doing the best with the awareness I have today. And it's so powerful, because they're still dealing with their dad, who is not... he's very dysfunctional, and it's really hard, you know, I have to be the balance to that. So it's been really good to have the tools of recovery to help me with my relationship with them. My relationships with women are growing. I've always been kind of afraid of relationships with men. I haven't had a lot of women friends until I came here. And now it's like, you know, I had like 6 or 7 texts today from women supporting me. And it's just such a... It's a huge blessing, because my mother taught me to fear people and women in general. So to be able to do that, to hug women, to talk to them, to be open with them, is really a big thing. It's a big thing. I think I've been really graced with a beautiful relationship with a man. It's really a deeply intimate experience that I've never had before. It's not childlike. It's me being an adult. It's really helped me deal with a lot of my core issues. It's like, we always joke we're in the laboratory, because it's like practicing all these things that we do in ACA and all the things that come up through my inner child in relationship, all those really self-protective behaviors and that fear of abandonment that come up so deeply when you're having a close relationship like that. The biggest thing for me is that I'm not asking this other person to fix me. I'm working on myself, and I'm having the relationship with my inner child. That child's not having the relationship with him, which is something I've never done before. And, you know, this person is also in recovery, and we work recovery together, but we also work our own programs. There's a lot of trust, honesty, and respect, and, you know, we're fellow travelers, which is just, it's so awesome. And there is none of that, you know, running away, chasing after, or hiding anymore. It's just like, it's transparent. It's honest. We talk about our feelings. There's none of this hiding from each other, and none of this manipulation or game playing. It's just been like, probably the biggest thing for me has been this relationship, because it's taught me and shown me how much I've grown, to be able to do this. So it's very powerful. And I think that I know that I would not be able to do this if it weren't for this program. I know I wouldn't. There's no way I would understand any of this. Another way that I'm returning to greater places of love is my recovery work. I'm working on my emotional sobriety every day. I do devotional. I have visuals in my house. I have program all over the place for myself. I do a probably like an hour-long devotional in the morning with journaling or reading and meditation. You know, I'm always inventorying my behavior, and I'm really learning to listen to my inner child and to slow down, because I'm a doer just like my mom, and I just want to keep going to run from those feelings, but I'm learning to be still, and it's not an easy thing to do. But the program gives me the tools to be able to do that, and I think I'm really facing my fear with courage. I'm having compassion for other people, and I'm connecting on a deeper level, and learning how to have truly intimate relationships in so many different ways. And this is actually part of my 10th step prayer, as I pray that, you know, I'll look at my behavior, but also take time to listen to my inner child and go encourage compassion and connection, because to me, that's the key thing. If I do that every day, I'm going to be in a good place. It definitely helps. I think the other component of returning to love is spirituality, definitely, for me. One of the things that's been a really huge blessing for me is I'm a part of a spiritual community, and I go there every Sunday, and it's been really helpful to just be in the presence of higher power, you know, and just have that reminder every week. I do a lot of meditating. I think the meditating really has been my bridge to my inner child, and it definitely helps me still my inner critic. Because I know if I don't meditate, I am a hot mess all day long. And I'm way, like, all over the place because I'm a doer. So the other part of that is I think that, you know, I continually go back to steps 1, 2, and 3 because fear does come up and I do get overwhelmed. And when I go back to that place and centering myself on higher power, things become a lot easier and they usually go a lot better that way than me trying to control everything around me. I have a really great relationship with my little girl. And when I saw that bear, I wish I would have brought Sugar Bear with me. I almost did, but I didn't. So how do I connect with my inner child? I'm really learning to know what she likes and needs. I'm building trust with her. I do a lot of non-dominant handwriting. And I just connect with her daily and just the ways that I know how. Through the non-dominant handwriting, I've learned a lot of things about her. She likes to be outside in the sun and run and bike and be at the beach. She likes music. She likes me to hug her. She's told me to hug her. She doesn't like to be alone. She does not want to be alone. That is for darn sure. I just do little things throughout my day to just check in. Like Sugar Bear sits on my bed, and when I'm going through the house doing all day long, I look at Sugar Bear and I say, oh, I need to check in with my little girl, and I pick her up and I just hug her and I say, okay. And take the time to go to that place, because I'll run away from her and not listen to her, and she does not like when I don't listen to her. It causes all kinds of problems. I do little things for myself while I'm at work. Sometimes I whistle when I walk down the hall because my little girl likes to whistle. She likes music. I listen to music all day long. And every single day I eat an apple with peanut butter because she likes the apple with peanut butter. And that makes me think about her and check in with her. So it's pretty awesome. I think the biggest thing, though, is acknowledging your feelings and not running from them. And just really, really just I keep telling her, you know, she's safe now. She can trust. And that I love her. I say, I love you, Maria. I'm amazing. I love you. And the beautiful thing is my daughter does that too, and I love it. I get her in front of the mirror, and she says, I'm amazing. I love you. And that, to me, is the most powerful gift, because I'm teaching her that because I come here. So the last thing I want to share is my hope. I, of course, want to continue to grow in this love because it's an awesome place to be. My life has never been so free and just beautiful and connected on so many levels. I use a vision board, actually. I'm going to talk a little bit about my vision board and what's on it. For the last 2 years in January, I've created a vision board, which if you don't know what that is, it's just like a poster board, and you put magazine pictures on it of what your intentions are for the year. And, you know, it's not specific things. It's just kind of like putting it out there, and they're going to manifest in the way that they want to be manifested. So one of the things that I have on my vision board for this year are to work on my feelings of shame and worthiness and lovability, to focus on me, and not to judge myself and listen to my inner critic, but to listen to myself and trust myself. To be an adult and do adulting in the best way that I know how. Continue to grow in my relationships with women and with John. And to integrate the 14 traits. I actually have a picture of my little girl at 3 when she was free and amazing and was not scared of the world, and me in the middle holding this chicken named Susie because my little girl loves animals. But in that picture, I see myself integrated. I see adult Maria, but I see the little kid in there, and I have this smile on my face, and it's like, that is who I want to be all the time. And then, of course, my kids are with that because I need to work on maintaining a loving relationship with them. And, of course, I want to continue being a loving parent to my little girl and working on that relationship with her. You know, there's been so many conditions on love, and I just really want to learn how to love unconditional and have less shame and fear in my life. I think sometimes a fear is like, it's like slaying a dragon. It almost feels like it's just so overwhelming, and I get in these frozen places. But, you know, there's a lot of times now, a lot more times now, where it just kind of feels like I'm wrestling this little bunny rabbit. So it's pretty... It's very much a relief in my life to not be in this state of constant fear. And of course, you know, I recognize that this is a process of letting go and trusting in higher power and myself and all of you in this group that have really taught me how to talk, trust, and feel. And, you know, I mean, honestly, like, I can say that I'm choosing to love my world from the inside out, and it's like, what a gift. What a beautiful gift. It's just the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me. It's like I always joke, it's like if I died tomorrow, I would die happy and I would be free, and it's like, I'm good. Life is good. So whatever life has to offer me now, bring it on, because you know what? I am proving to myself that I do have courage. And that I can do whatever I set my mind to, because you know what? If you told me 2 years that I would be standing here talking to all of you, I'd have been like, that will never happen. This is living proof that I am blessed and thankful to be part of this loving family. So thank you for being here, and thank you for all the gifts and joy and love that you bring to me. And that's all I have.